Thanks very much, Blessing Zulu. Good evening, Zimbabwe. It's 17 hours 20 UTC, 7:20 p.m. in Zimbabwe on Saturday, March 19th, 2016. You're listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America in Washington. Thank you for joining us from Washington. This is Gibbs Dube. Here are our top stories this evening. ZANU-PF and opposition party officials say it may be difficult to recover $15 billion in potential diamond revenue, which was allegedly looted in Zimbabwe.
The $15 billion is our rough estimate, because like the president said, these were the alluvial diamonds, which were right on top. So it was really a question of digging slightly and picking up. So how would you know how many of these colors were picked? There is no way.
A research indicates that women are still struggling to access housing programs in urban areas. And as usual, we'll focus on women's issues. ZANU-PF and opposition party officials say it may be difficult to recover $15 billion in potential diamond revenue, which was allegedly looted in Zimbabwe. Speaking in a political panel, Nick Mangwana of ZANU-PF and George Mkwananzi of the People's Democratic Party, led by Tendai Biti, agreed that blocking diamond mining loopholes is an insurmountable task. Mkwananzi says Biti, who is Zimbabwe's former finance minister, tried in vain to inform President Robert Mugabe's government about the leakages in the mining of diamonds in Manicaland. But Mangwana says it is untrue that ZANU-PF always wanted to work against Biti.
I think I agree with him on a lot of issues. What I don't agree with him on is this idea that Tendai Biti was a miracle worker who was picking this and picking that, and everything was being used to sabotage him. Because even after the Tendai Biti, after 2013, when in 2016, no money or no substantial amounts of money went into the coffers, into the fiscus. No, nothing went to the exchequer. So it wasn't about Tendai Biti. It wasn't about the GNU. It was because there were holes. It was because there were loopholes. And those loopholes remained. And it was because we are new into this diamond trade, and we learned a hard lesson, and for that matter, a very expensive lesson, which costed us $15 billion. Other people have been doing it for a long time. We are novices, and clearly we are inefficient and ineffective, or we were. From now on, we are trying to tighten up things and move forward and make the country benefit from its natural resources. That's where we are at.
But Mr. Mkwananzi, is it possible to actually plug the leakages?
It takes political will, but as long as there are some people who are benefiting from the leakages will be deliberately allowed to continue. So it must first be a decision at a political level that we want our natural resources to benefit Zimbabweans, not individuals in cahoot with foreigners who are coming to loot and leverage on our resources.
I totally agree with that. I totally identify with that sentiment. That's what it is. No thief wants the door locked. So if the thief sees that people are about to lock the door and he has got the responsibility, he's a locksmith, then you've got a problem. But if the thief is identified and removed, then we can change the locks.
But is it possible to identify the people who stole the diamonds, Mr. Mkwananzi?
It should be possible as long as they know who was put where to do what. Then they should retrace their steps and see whether those people were doing their job. What is it that went through their fingers which was not supposed to do so? And then they hold each person in each area where they were deployed to account for all the leakages that happened under their nose. They should be able to identify these people and bring them to book. If the Chinese manage to spirit out this diamond into their country or elsewhere where they sold them, surely there must be a way to make them to account and return our resources.
And lastly, Mr. Mangwana, can it be possible for them to return these resources?
Very unlikely. Like I said, for the nature of the crime itself was to make sure the water is as muddied as possible, so there is nothing to track. We've got reports of an airstrip where nothing was going through customs. People were just sprinting, like Israel rightly saying, things out. So straight from the mine into the plane. How can you account for that? The same system that was responsible for the whole value chain is still was responsible for the accounting as well. So really, the $15 billion is our rough estimate. Because like the president saying, these were the alluvial diamonds, which were right on top. So it was really a question of digging slightly and picking up. So how would you know how many of these colors were picked. There is no way. It basically means that they somehow navigated around the whole Kimberley process of certification of the diamonds. This was an organized crime. So like all organized crime, it's very difficult to get through the syndicate. You can stop it now, right, like we have done, but to track, we can't. There's dishonest, there's ineptitude. Our own people probably are guilty of dishonesty. Oh, sorry, of ineptitude. And some may be dishonest. Those ones, what you can simply do is fire them. What can you do? Can you charge them with a crime when actually all they did was to slip on the job? The problem is the ones which were dishonest. How do we track them? How do we know? Even all of us were simply circa, meaning approximately. Nobody knows. That's the whole nature of the crime. So we only, as I said, we hope the man will be recovered. It will be a good boost to our economy. But to be pragmatic, I would say don't hold your breath.
That was Nick Mangwana of ZANU-PF. You also heard from George Mkwananzi, deputy spokesperson of the People's Democratic Party, speaking with Studio 7. President Robert Mugabe announced recently that his government only received about $2 billion in diamond revenue from manikling fields. All companies mining diamonds have been ordered to cease operations. A recent research shows that Zimbabwe has not been adequately responding to rural urban migration, resulting in the continued marginalization of women regarding access to housing and other services. Our correspondent Itaurai Shaba brings us more.
The research titled Unearthing Exclusions Towards More Inclusive Zimbabwean Cities looked at gender equality in relation to women's experiences in urban areas. Consultant Shan Maseko told Studio 7 on the sidelines of a recent stakeholders meeting to disseminate some of the findings that the research was carried out in two residential areas each in Bulawayo, Harare and Kadoma, focusing on three main areas: housing, services and violence. Maseko said one of the major findings of the research is that there is a serious housing shortage resulting in overcrowding, which in turn leaves women vulnerable. She said most of those in need of accommodation cannot afford to buy housing stands or houses, and women remain disenfranchised owing to a number of institutional hindrances as well as corruption, barring them from accessing housing services as individuals. On service provision, Maseko said the research also showed that government had not been well prepared for the post-independence surge in rural to urban migration, which put a strain on infrastructure and services, especially water as well as sanitation.
I think one of the critical things is the fact that urban spaces were designed predominantly for single men who were also working in those areas. And then post-independence, that shifted. And now they became areas for families, households, and thriving communities. And certainly in the case of Mbare and Makakoba, also centres for business, informal trading, and a lot of activity. And really this was looking at whether those spaces had responded to that shift and the extent to which the gender inequalities had shifted, had changed in any way.
The research, done over a three-year period from 2013, was part of an international research project called Safe and Inclusive Cities. It was carried out by the Women's Law Center at the University of Zimbabwe in collaboration with Oxfam Canada and was led by Professor Julie Stewart. Rosalie Katsande, a PhD candidate with the Women's Law Center and co-lead researcher, said there were many similarities in the areas in which the study was undertaken.
It's amazing how the findings duplicate themselves in the three cities. I think basically mainly due to the historical, right, going back in history, pre-independence, post-independence, because you can see Mbare, you can easily equate it with Makokova and even Rimuka in Kadoma, because these are pre-independent settlements or townships. It's the same issues of overcrowding, several families in the same rooms. I can't call them houses, right? These are rooms that were made for single men, but now they are accommodating families.
Turning to the issue of violence, Maseko said although the research also showed that women consider interpersonal violence as a serious problem, many of the other problems that they ranked above it are part of what is known as structural violence, which is described as, quote, everyday violence or part of the normative fabric in social and political life. She said there was a link between interpersonal violence, particularly domestic, and structural violence involving access to justice, adding that structural violence worsens domestic violence.
I think the key findings really are around the fact that structural violence is pervasive and very complex, and particularly for women in terms of their experiences with institutions, accessing services, accessing houses.
The research also found that there was a correlation between men's unemployment and increase in domestic violence, with some women revealing that their husbands' loss of jobs meant that their husbands stayed at home more, limiting their freedom to also engage in income-generating projects and help look after their families. The researchers say they will share their findings with policymakers so as to help ensure that the problems identified in the research can be addressed. Reporting for Studio 7 from Lawayo, this is Taurai Shaba.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to promoting religious freedom around the world, including in South Asia. Ambassador at Large for Religious Freedom David Saperstein said that while there have been positive developments from both governments and civil society in South Asia, serious challenges remain. In Pakistan, the government has made significant efforts under its National Action Plan to combat sectarianism and violent extremism. However, violence against religious minorities at the hands of extremists continues. In addition, blasphemy laws are still on the books and convictions still occur, with over 20 people currently sentenced to death or serving life sentences for blasphemy convictions. The United States opposes blasphemy laws, apostasy laws, and punishment of conversion laws everywhere. Such legislation is too frequently used to oppress those whose religious beliefs differ from the majority. In India, faith communities are mobilizing to challenge violent extremism. At the same time, India has seen its share of communal violence. One non-governmental organization reported that there was an attack on a Christian almost every day in 2015 in India. Sri Lanka is in the process of drafting a new constitution and is one of the few situations where there has been notable change in a positive direction, said Ambassador Saperstein. January brought the arrest of the leader of Bodu Balasena, a violent group that victimized Sri Lanka's religious minorities. In Nepal, ethnic and religious tensions remain, and the constitution includes a provision against conversions. In Bangladesh, extremists have targeted secular bloggers, brutally murdering them. The U.S. is also concerned about an increase in violence against religious minorities and their places of worship by militants claiming affiliation with ISIL. No nation, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has said, can fulfill its potential if its people are denied the right to practice, to hold, to modify, to openly profess their innermost beliefs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
You're listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America in Washington. We are broadcasting on 909 Metam Wave and on the 4930, 5940 and 15460 shortwave frequencies. And now, as usual, it's time for the Women's Forum.
Welcome to the Women's Forum, a forum where we look at issues affecting women. I'm Marvelous Mhlanga Nyahuye. Tonight on the Women's Forum, we have the pleasure of speaking to the AU Goodwill Ambassador on Early Child Marriages, Nyaradzai Gumbonjanda, who is in New York attending the United Nations Commission Status on Women meeting, which is currently underway and will end next week. Welcome to the Women's Forum, Mrs. Gumbonjanda.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about this meeting. What impact will it have on the women's movement and how important is it?
60th UN Commission on the Status of Women is the first commission meeting since the adoption of the Sustainable Development Goals by the General Assembly last year. And the focus is on women's empowerment and sustainable development. We have negotiations going on, focusing on how can we move from commitment to implementation for us to achieve gender equality and women's rights. We have been very much involved in creating space for young people. We had a pre-CSW forum for youth, which is the first youth forum for CSW that we have ever had, where young people are also raising their recommendations on what needs to be included and what they want to see their governments prioritize. There's a very strong message that we need opportunities for young people, economic opportunities, and that education needs to go beyond primary education. Very strong recommendations around young women and health, especially around sexual and reproductive health and rights, and a strong lobby from the Southern Africa region around HIV and the need to support people living with HIV, especially young women. And of course, the issue of child marriage and forced marriage is very high on the agenda, since this is also one of the targets of the SDGs.
And from your observation, what is the importance of including the youth? Especially, you say this was the first inaugural youth conference that you've had at CSW.
First, it's important that we understand that the young people who are 15 years today would be 30 years by the year 2030. Those who are 20 in their 20s would be in their 40s. And so it's important that young people are the ones who are being impacted by the issues, but they are also the decision makers of tomorrow around these issues. And young people, looking at it demographically, we know in the world that we have today, the world is becoming younger and younger demographically, and we have more young people and more women. So we always say the future is getting to be young and female. And that data itself tells us that young people are going to be decision makers, they are going to be producers of knowledge or products, and the main consumer base just from an economic perspective. And yet they are the ones who are impacted by lack of opportunities to education, they are the ones who are dying more due to maternal deaths. And so it's just natural that we must place the issues of young people, especially young women and girls, at the center.
You talked about the importance of implementation, especially when you've come up with recommendations from some of these conferences. But are you getting any commitment? We understand the Zimbabwean government is represented there. What kind of commitment are you getting?
I had an opportunity to meet in the corridors with some of the government officials who are here, from both the ministry and some of the members of parliament, from the Women Parliamentary Caucus. And this morning I had consultations with the Zimbabwean NGOs from Zwala, Wilsa, Kat, Charlie, Rosaria Memorial Trust, very strong. And they were very clear. The civil society and women's groups are clear that, yes, we need all these global commitments, but we need at the national level practical interventions. We need laws that protect women's rights. So there's a lot of excitement around the constitutional decision relating to child marriage, but it's also how do we move from just having a constitutional decision to actually having legislation that comprehensively address the issue of child and forced marriage in Zimbabwe.
Time is not on our side. Thank you very much, Mrs. Nyaradzai Gumbonjanda, for having been our guest on the Women's Forum, a forum where we look at issues affecting women.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Marvelous Mhlanganya Huye.
Thanks very much, Marvelous Mhlanganya Huye. We hope you are going to have a good weekend. The music of Peter Tosh coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. Now to recap today's top stories. ZANU-PF and opposition party officials say it may be difficult to recover $15 billion in potential diamond revenue, which was allegedly looted in Zimbabwe. And a research indicates that women are still struggling to access housing programs in urban areas. That's our broadcast this evening. Now stand by for Studio 7 in Ndebele with Chris Gande. This is Kip Stube in Washington, D.C., wishing you a pleasant evening and a very, very good night.